Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Stage Door Johnny, or welcome to it. And if you haven't heard the first part of this chat with Emily Mortimer and Alessandra Nivola that I recorded live at Jermyn Street Theatre in London just before Christmas, then do yourself a favour, go back and listen to part one, act one of this conversation, because it's good stuff and it doesn't disappoint in part two. We had just left it with Emily having had a traumatic experience playing Portia in A Merchant of Venice in Scotland, an experience from which she's still not quite recovered when it comes to the theatre. And this is where we pick up our chat.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have the house for Act Two. Mr. Cake, Mr. Nivola, and Miss Mortimer to the stage for Act Two, please. And Miss Mortimer, please mind your head.
So wait, am I right in thinking after Portia, you didn't go back on stage until we did our play in New York?
And that's the last time we went back into...
Just a play called Parlor Song, which we did at the Atlantic Theatre.
Yes.
Three-hander, you, me, and a brilliant American actor called Chris Bauer.
Yes.
But it's so fascinating that you talk about this business of the intrusive thoughts.
Yes.
And wanting to call things out, because your dad, who had this amazingly interesting sort of relationship to performance too, right? He sort of always wanted to be a performer,
yes,
I think, and
yeah,
carried on doing his one-man show, Mortimer's Miscellany.
Yes.
I think until...
until he died,
his final days. But do you remember when we went to the theatre with him?
Yes.
When he was the chairman of the Royal Court.
Yes.
The chairman of the Royal Court, you know, the Royal Court bastion of new writing in this country, you know, absolutely national institution. John was the chairman. And we went to, in my memory, it's the opening night
of Blasted.
Of Blasted by Sarah Kane. You know, which was, if anybody doesn't know, an incredibly formative theatrical experience in the late 90s.
Yes, it would have been.
The sort of emergence of brutalist theatre. Sarah Kane, who tragically died very young, was a real new voice in the theatre. It was a sort of unprecedented and incredibly in-your-face and a difficult watch. And do you want to tell this story?
You tell it, because you're better at
I
than
don't
me.
Know if I...
You well, I'll join in. You
Please
start.
Join in. So the first line of this play, we've all come to see this kind of event, theatre, because there's been some buzz about it. It's really divided, you know, people saying, this is disgraceful, this is disgusting, it's so violent and extreme. And so we take our places for the first night. I'm sitting next to John and Emily's on the other side. And a brilliant actor called Neil Dudgeon comes through the doors and goes, I've shat in better places than this. To which John, in his inimitably high treble, says, awfully witty line, one of Noel Coward's finest. And from that moment on, there are two plays. There is the extraordinary, you know, legendary performance of this thing that's going on, and there's an evening with John Mortimer going on in there, where he was speaking his intrusive thoughts all the time, and it was sort of not enough to interfere with the performance, but certainly enough that the rows around him were like, it was a sort of live stream, it was a sort of DVD commentary by John Mortimer on this incredible play. And there was a moment, wasn't there, where a guy was lying sort of slumped underneath, it was some sort of burnt out bomb site in Sarajevo or something, and your dad said,
is he shitting or is he dying? At which point,
water came from the flies and sort of plopped onto his face and woke him up and went, oh no, he was only shitting. I mean, it was uncontrollably extraordinary. And I don't know about you, but I sat in this sort of rictus of sweaty horror, feeling for my fellow actors on stage, but also feeling like I was also witnessing sort of stereo history.
Yeah, but his dad did that. That is actually really? In A Voyage Around My Father. He was basically copying his dad because he would take his dad to the RSC and as our dad did, no, he knew all the complete works of Shakespeare from start to finish off by heart. Right. But he always said that his dad would be a great help to the actors because he'd say the lines and he'd say them about 3 seconds before they got to them very loudly in the front row because he was blind. And that was like, and it was mortifying, I think, for our dad. But then, you know, the sins of the fathers.
I'll never forget it. He was the chairman of the theatre. That's what was so exciting.
But the other great thing he did as the chairman of the theatre was he met Tom Cruise and Stephen Daldry on the steps of the Royal Court Theatre, and he had no idea because Stephen Daldry was the artistic director at the time. Of course, my dad had no idea who Tom Cruise was, and he asked Stephen Daldry what he wanted to drink, and Stephen Daldry said a gin and tonic or something, and then Dad said, "Oh, and a Coca Cola for the little chap."
I mean, God, I miss John all the time. Alessandro, you went from Yale and you did some off-Broadway stuff, but then you did a production of As You Like It at Williamstown with Gwyneth Paltrow, you playing Orlando, Gwyneth playing Rosalind, and then you were sort of quite soon catapulted onto Broadway playing opposite Helen Mirren in Turgenev's Month in the Country.
Well, you have the chronology a little backwards, no. Which was that I, only a few months after graduating from Yale, I was catapulted onto Broadway with Helen Mirren.
There you go.
And it was all downhill from there.
See. Is Gwyneth Paltrow downhill? Not necessarily.
No, that was after like an 8-year hiatus.
Oh, was it? God, I really
from the theater. Yeah, so I
take Wikipedia to tell
I us. Went. No, I went straight onto Broadway.
What was
way
that
over my head?
What do you remember of that production? What do you remember of Helen? Was she fierce?
So she had just starred in Prime Suspect,
yeah.
And I remember thinking that was like the best thing I'd ever seen on television. I guess it was on television. I can't really
remember. Yeah, yeah.
It was like the first serialized thing of any kind that I thought, oh, this is just totally brilliant. Like, I can't think of anything before that was serialized that I thought was cool. And that was just brilliant. And I really kind of had a crush on her. I didn't know at the time about her reputation as being like someone in control of her, you know, one of the first sort of women of the theater to be in control of her own sexual destiny.
Gosh.
And that she could just like have any man she wanted. I mean, that was what her reputation was. And she sort of like cut a swath through all the kind of leading men of the time. And, you know, from Liam Neeson. Yeah. All the kind of like studs or whatever she just like took on and then cast aside. And, you know, just really cool and really sexy. And once I was cast in this part, which was in A Month in the Country, which was it's about a woman who falls in love with the tutor of her daughter. And I was playing the tutor. And once I was cast in the thing, I started doing my research. And the more I started learning about her and everything, the more I was thinking, oh, my God, she's just amazing. And like, and she loves younger guys. And, like, this could be something.
I come back to my very first thing about the theater being an aphrodisiac. I'm just going to, you know, rest my case.
Look,
keep going.
I was 22
years
old.
Sure, she's Helen Mirren.
And we got into the rehearsals, and I think I was pretty bad. I mean, I'm pretty sure I was pretty bad. Because, so the director who gave me my Broadway debut ended up, like, I've worked with multiple times.
Scott Ellis.
Yes, and he ended up directing me in The Elephant Man.
Yeah.
And so I've worked with him since a lot. But at the time, like...
You can't have been that bad then.
I was just really nervous. And I think he was even more nervous about me than I was about myself. And he was trying to kind of micromanage my performance. And I remember her standing on the other side of him when he was giving me some direction. And I remember her going like...
Whoa.
Like saying...
So Alessandro is miming in one ear and out the other.
Yes. And so... It was interesting to me to hear that, because what she was really saying was like, trust your own instincts. I wouldn't have put it in those terms at that time. But
she was sort of indicating to you to disregard what he was saying.
Yeah, in one ear, out the other.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought
like,
it meant
don't pay any attention.
Am I just being very obtuse?
To the man behind the curtain.
Got it. I thought you were implying that she was saying to Scott, he's not understanding what you're saying, but that's because...
No. She was saying to me, don't listen.
Sorry.
Just like go for it,
right.
Basically.
Right.
And I didn't totally understand that that's what it meant. And I didn't even know how to interpret it like that at the time. But I did get some impression that she was telling me like, you kind of got this and he doesn't know what he's talking about. And I took it as like, she likes me.
She's making ear gestures. Yeah.
And so then I guess I grew in confidence as the play went on. Mm-hmm. And there was a scene where I had to take her hand and kiss her hand and then kiss up her arm and everything. And it got, you know, and then we were interrupted just before, you know, it got really exciting. And one night, I really kind of got carried away, and I kind of bit her hand.
Oh, goodness me.
And I remember it really was. She has a tattoo on her hand right here. There was like this little, like weird little tattoo that they had covered up with makeup, and the makeup had just rubbed off a little bit, and that was where I bit her hand. And then like... It, you know, the play went on. I mean, I didn't like, not like a hurting her, but I just, I, you know, it was just like a love bite, you know what
sure.
I mean?
Sure. Back to your furry animal beginning.
And as the night went on, like it happened in a sort of, you know, it was probably the most spontaneous thing I'd done in the whole performance before or after that. And as the night went on, the spontaneity of it kind of wore off, and I started like thinking back to that moment and wondering if that had been a good idea or not.
Oh, God.
And the longer the night went on, the more I thought maybe it wasn't such a good idea. So then the next day we came into the theater, and normally she'd always come in and be like, you know, hi, you know, how was your weekend and all, you know, all this kind of thing. And sort of, you know, she was very affectionate with everybody in the cast. I thought maybe a little more affectionate with me than other people. But,
she's only flesh and blood.
You know, and the next day she just like breezed by me and didn't say anything at all. And then the same thing happened the day after that and then the day after that. And so then 3 days had gone by and she really hadn't spoken to me. And I thought, like, I was thinking back, like, in my dressing room at the intermission, what have I done? Like, what have I done? And then the hand bite, you know, popped into my head. And I was like, oh, my God. I bit her hand. And she's pissed off, and like, what an idiot. Like, why did I do that? Like, that was so stupid, you know? And so I sat down, and I was like, okay, how do I fix this? And I wrote this, like, chivalric letter to her that was like, dear Miss Mirren, you know, you know, not yet. This is long before that.
Sure, but you will be.
I was overtaken in this moment. The other thing was that, like, before that, leading up to that time, I used to go up to her dressing room, and there was a couch in her dressing room, and I would lie out on this couch in her dressing room and kind of like, and she would sit over there, and she had her mirror in front of her, and she would sit at her table with the mirror up, and she would flip through these pages of of a magazine, and then she would occasionally look up in the mirror and see me like back on her couch,
kind of like.
Like a hot
lunch.
Know,
like staring at her in the mirror. and then that led up to the hand bite. Anyway, and so then. And it's so.
Magnificent portrait of backstage life. Keep going.
Now I just think like she was just tolerating me lying on her couch in her dressing room. Like, yeah, I mean, it must have been.
It's a scene from Les Lions.
She just wanted to sit and like read her magazine, but there was this guy like. So anyway, so I wrote the note and. And I, you know, please forgive me for having nibbled on your
tattoo
on your hand. And I, you know, it just, you know, it came over me in this moment. And I know that it was like disrespectful. And, you know, I promise it won't happen again. And then I had my dresser. I said, you know, could you please transmit this missive to Miss Mirren. And so like the dresser like took it up to her dressing room, which was upstairs. And then I sat there just kind of waiting for the response. And then I heard from upstairs like a door swing open and down she came, like down the stairway, and then slammed open my dressing room door, and she was there in her like corset, like, and I think nothing else. I mean, no, she had her like her underwear on, and like, but she was almost naked in her corset, and she slammed open the door, and she had the note in her hand, crumpled up, and she said, "Do you really take me for that much of a prude?" And she threw it in my bin in my dressing room and slammed the door and walked out.
I thought she was.
It was never mentioned.
Oh, that's magnificent. I thought you were going to say she's going to pin you up against the wall and finally you'd have your Helen Mirren moment. That's fantastic.
Keiki, can I ask you to tell, well, I don't know whether on your podcast, just talking of backstage life, because it makes me laugh often to myself. And I just think it suddenly came to me, the story of the, I shan't be making the mezzanine. Can you tell them that? Because I just think, has that been on Stage Door Johnny? It really is the best story. And it is a good
such
indicator.
A non sequitur.
No, but it's backstage
yes,
life.
You're right.
It's the
you're
sort
right.
of like, it's the sort of the best bit, in my opinion. Like, if it was only the backstage life, I wouldn't be, I'd love doing plays because that bit is the sort of like the chaos and the mess and the kind of these slightly sort of crazy, demented characters, and everybody's just a mess.
Just after I left drama school, I went to the RSC, which at the time was doing a year in Stratford and a year in the Barbican in London. And I was doing, you know, as everybody does, sort of four or five plays, and you've got one decent part and you're understudying everybody else. And there was a guy who was a sort of Stratford lifer who'd been there for God knows, 30 years, and had once obviously been a fantastic actor, still was, but had not been asked to exert himself for some decades. And he also liked to drink. And it was New Year's Day, and I happened to be clocking in with my pass into the stage door for the show on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, and everybody was feeling a bit, you know, the worse for wear. And I heard a voice message being played by the stage door manager, and it was this guy. He said, "Hello, this is my sister speaking." I wish I was making this up. I'm afraid I will not be able to make the matinee this afternoon. Thank you. Click, that was it. And I was like, that you just have heard. I passed by at the exact moment that he said, "Hello, this is my sister speaking." It's just extraordinary. Wait, how did we get there? Yes, okay, listen, we've got to wind this up because it's Christmas and everybody needs to go, and it's going to be Christmas Day soon. Listen, what's the most important thing here that we haven't covered that we should? Okay, well, let's ask this. You talk about that amazing moment of suddenly something coming over you in the theatre and you end up biting the grand dame leading lady's hand. What we do on stage, but also, of course, on film and TV and everything else, what we do deals with these very complicated grey areas of human interaction, very complicated grey areas of human behaviour, human thought. You know, a lot of drama comes out of emergency, comes out of transgression, comes out of nothing that is safe or sanitized. As we are, you know, we all started doing this a while ago, but now we're in 2023. Are you concerned about how possible it is to be brave, to be unafraid in rehearsal rooms, to be free in what we do? Does it feel like we live in a culture now which is more inhibited about that stuff? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? How does it affect you artistically?
That's really a hard question, but I think it's a good, important question. I do think that sort of, oh my God, it's also hard not to talk about it without sounding like very annoying probably. But I do think that like, that especially the theatre is, maybe the theatre more than ever now, therefore, is like really important because it's a place where people can be transgressive and have always been. And the kind of spoken words is, I mean, that's why, you know, in Shakespeare's plays or whatever, he always gave the sort of political things to the comics, to the right. You know, the bits that weren't written down where they could extemporize and say kind of radical stuff. And mm. and our dad was a playwright, but he was also a criminal defense barrister, and he defended a lot of people that had done terrible things and a lot of murderers, and
he liked murderers.
Yes, he thought murderers were the best kind of clients.
Salt of the earth.
Well, they generally got rid of the one person on earth that was sort of annoying them. And therefore, those kind of, they were very well behaved. Mm. Peace had descended. But he said that, no, that murder is a very human crime, and that it's something that we're all probably at some point mm-hmm. in a weird moment capable of, whereas we might not sell drugs or sort of diddle our taxes. But it's a human yeah. crime. And his education to me and Rosie and all our siblings probably was like, you can be a good person and kill someone and a bad person and never get a parking ticket. Obviously, you can be a terrible person and kill someone and a good person mm-hmm. and never get a parking ticket too. But that kind of radical way of thinking and that sort of forgiving way of thinking is, I think in order to be a good writer and a good performer, you have to think like that, as well as to be a good barrister. You mm-hmm. have to be able to have a kind of, to think that everybody deserves the right to a fair hearing, that everybody's story deserves to be told. Macbeth's story deserves to be right. told just as much as Cordelia's story deserves to be told. And actually, in understanding Macbeth and Lady Macbeth and kind of feeling for them, you are put more in touch with your own humanity.
Completely.
And that's why plays are so important. And all of this is so important. And so in this moment where everybody's sort of feeling like, because of this cultural moment that we're living in, where we all have to sort of have a sort of stance on something, and everything has to be so black and white, and people are good or bad, and there's, you know, a way to think that is right and a way to think that is wrong. It's cool that there are kind of people that are writing plays and appearing in plays and putting on films or whatever that are trying to. I do think people in our world are battling that,
yeah.
and that is, yes, I think, I don't feel like everybody's too frightened to sort of try to keep telling stories that are difficult and challenging and hard. I don't feel like I'm despairing of the arts as a place where difficult conversations can still right. happen. I don't know.
Well, that's very good. Would you be biting an actress's hand today?
Sure. All I know is we're in the midst of a correction, and it's a necessary one. And, you know, cultures have to go to extremes to sort of fix problems. And that's kind of what's happening now. But it just sucks because, like, the end result is hopefully going to be wonderful. But right now it's kind of sucky because you just feel like everything's political. And I'm not that into political theater or storytelling that, you know, is polemic. And so and you almost can't pitch something, you can't propose something, you can't, and even if you're telling a story that isn't designed that way, it's re-examined through that kind of a lens. And so, yeah, in those ways, like, it's oppressive. But I'm sure out of that is going to, you know, come something better than what came before. But sexual politics aside and, you know, all that, I still, like, feel like I missed the golden age of, you know, movies and theater, which was 60s and 70s.
Are you excited to be back on the stage again?
Yeah. I mean, it's been 8 years or something since I did The Elephant Man. The Elephant Man almost killed me. I mean, mainly
because... You did it for so long, in three different iterations.
Yeah, we did it at the Williamstown Theater Festival, yeah, which was like a summer stock thing that Bradley Cooper had asked me to do with him just as on a lark. Like, yeah, you know, we were just going to do it for a few weeks over the summer. And then it was a hit there. And then he said, you know, how about we do it on Broadway? And then we did it on Broadway and it was a hit there. And then he was like, how about we do it in the West End? It wasn't so much of a hit here. And he was like, how about we do it in Sydney? And I was like, no, enough. I mean, this could have gone on for years. And it nearly killed me. Like the production was sort of a beautiful production. He was phenomenal in it. I got my Tony nomination out of it, but it really was not one of the most enjoyable roles I've played. And it was kind of like, it was painful after, you know, the eighth performance of the week. We were sharing a dressing room, and, you know, he has got some other thing going in his veins than I do. And it's the source of his incredible energy and drive and determination and success. And it's, you know, totally to be admired. But like when we were sharing a dressing room after the eighth show of the week, and he was coming in saying, like, you know, bro, do you realize how privileged we are to be doing this tonight, you know? And I was like hollowed eyed and just like staring, like I was like a shell of a, like a cadaver looking at myself in the mirror, like, I can't do it again. I can't do it again. And like, he was like, come on, man, this is, you know, we're going to do this. And wow. You know, and then once we got out there, like, it was amazing doing the play with him. Talk about spontaneity. Like, he insisted that it be different every single night. And it really was. Like, from night to night, the show was very different and our scenes were all really different. And it was like very exciting to act with him. And I'm a huge admirer of him. But there's a picture of us on our holiday, like, finally, when the play was over. And M took it of me, and I'm like lying in this thing, and my head is, and I like, there's drool coming out of my mouth, and I like, my head is in an awkward position, and I think I slept for like 72 hours, and it made me kind of feel like I just needed a break.
It's so exhausting.
And
I think I do want to do it. I would love to. Jules, you're wonderful wife, and I was saying yesterday, she said she'd like to do a play here, and I said I'd do a play with Julianne here, because this feels manageable. This doesn't feel, I feel like I might not shout something weird out.
Stella,
I might not even think of it.
You're listening to this. Yeah. This is like, it's just like a booking agency, this podcast. This is fantastic.
But
I wonder if I get any kind of commission.
I was meant to do a play in COVID. I had been cast in a play by Nick Payne,
yeah,
that was to be directed by Tommy Cahill, who directed Hamilton. And I was shitting it, and because it was on Broadway, and I was just like, I mean, I was literally thinking, I don't know, I've got to go to sort of like therapy and get lots of, I don't know, major drugs or something to be able to do
this. Beta blocker.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried beta blockers?
No, I probably should try beta blockers. People say that really does help. That really apparently does help.
They wear off like everything else. I haven't tried them, but I think it's...
What, during a performance?
No, I just think that your body gets, you know, if you're taking...
Oh, so you have to take more and more?
Yeah.
Anyway, I can remember the first, that March the 10th, when was it that COVID struck? And my first thought was, Oh, thank God. I don't think I have to do that. I felt like I'd been given a reprieve. Yeah. But I can remember some nights with you and Chris doing Jez's play, because that really was an amazing play. And
you were called a sly stunner by the New York Times.
Really?
Sly stunner.
Oh, well, God, that definitely makes me want to do another play. Yes. But no, I do remember the feeling, because I've only scuba dived once, but I was very scared of that. And I remember doing
with
it, though.
With Keke, right?
With Keke.
Oh, yes.
In Australia.
In Australia.
Yeah.
That's when we first met.
Yes.
The terrible film of Noah's Ark.
Yes.
With John Voight.
We went to the Whitsun Sunday Island. Yeah, John Voight was God.
God
his
and
dream,
Noah.
His dream part.
Yeah, but his dream part.
I remember the feeling of scuba diving. You're so scared, but you're in it together, and that thing where you're not allowed to go up unless you all, if one of you goes up, all of you have to go up, and there's all these sort of hand signals, and you have to look at each other in the eye, you know, and sort of do that and do that. And I can remember thinking that slightly, like there is a feeling right. when you're in a play right. with people where you're like, it's a bit like that feeling of you, it's kind of all for one and one for all.
Yeah.
And you look into the other person's eyes and you kind of with them,
we
you know, and you're
and
taking each
good.
Other, you're sort of with each other, sort of getting through this hellish
yeah.
thing. And it can be really wonderful. Yeah. And I mean, I've got to do it, but holy shit, man, it was so scary. But all good things are scary.
Great. You heard it here first. Emily Mortimer, Julianne Nicholson, German Street Theatre, available for musicals. I will take a small but meaningful commission. ladies and gentlemen, Alessandra Nivola, Emily Mortimer.
Well, bravo. Bravo, Emily and Alessandro. I could not have enjoyed that more. Oh, thank you so much, both of them, for giving me that time and doing that live performance. And I thought the spirit of Emily's dad, Sir John Mortimer, was really with us that night. The spirit of free speech, free inquiry, free thinking, all John's freewheeling, devil-may-care, and intellectual rigour, as well as just that sheer brio. I loved it. I thought it was just a lovely night. Listen, please stay tuned for news of more live shows, more live Stage Door Johnnies from German Street Theatre. One that I can tell you about when I think there's a few tickets left that's upcoming is Sunday, March the 3rd of this year, 2024, featuring the brilliant Jez Butterworth, playwright extraordinaire, and his leading lady of his last three plays, Laura Donnelly, Olivier Award-winning for his last play, The Ferryman, and the star of their new play together, The Hills of California, which is at the Harold Pinter Theatre. It will be wonderful to talk about their collaboration with them. Buy tickets if you can. And keep an eye out for more live shows. My guest next week was the Guardian theatre critic for 48 years. And at the Times, for 6 years before that, he was an aisle squatter, as he likes to call it, for 54 years. And not just any theatre critic, he was the theatre critic, the one that everybody in the profession in the UK, for sure, read religiously. Every morning, everyone would want to know what Michael Billington thought of the show. Well, I can tell you what Michael Billington thought of the last 54 years because we have such a fantastically exhaustive and enjoyable look back over his extraordinary life and what he conservatively estimates is 10,000 nights in the theatre. Please join me next week for my chat with Michael Billington. Thank you so much to my producer, the brilliant Ben Backhouse. Thanks to the musicians, Iggy and Phoebe Cake, for the theme tune. Thank you to the stage manager. Thank you to you for listening. Thank you again to Emily Mortimer, Alessandra Nivola. Please join me next week. You won't regret it, I think. Michael has had an amazing life. And to get the view from the other side, from the police side of the stalls as opposed to the outlaws on stage is fascinating. Stage.